Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Welcome back to the Missing Maura Murray podcast. I'm Tim here today in the Crawl Space Studios with Lance. What's up, Lance?
How's it going today, Tim?
It's going great. We are very close to CrimeCon.
Yeah, we are anxiety-filled about this CrimeCon. Not bad anxiety. I'd say anticipation and some positive energy going on.
Right. If you're at CrimeCon, please come and see us. We're going to be on Podcast Row. We're also going to be doing a screening on Friday night. We have a live Missing Maura Murray on Friday and a live Crawl Space on Saturday. So check the schedules, please.
I just want to talk about this screening, which is going to be a unique experience for people. Everyone's asking about the documentary and where it's at, and this is a cut of the documentary that you won't see anywhere else.
Literally will not ever be seen ever again.
It in the form that you see it, you will never see that again. This is a CrimeCon
exclusive
screening. It features our introduction into the world of the obsession with the disappearance of Maura Murray, and just naturally that introduction is made by James Renner, and we go to Canada, and that is where it all starts.
Right, and so after the screening this Friday night at CrimeCon in Nashville, we're going to have a little Q&A. Maggie Freeling from The Oxygen Show is going to be there as well, and there is some new information that we have been supplied for this CrimeCon, so that's going to be pretty cool. So please be there at the live podcast if you can, and at the Q&A and screening.
And the date is Friday, May 4th, and this was just by happenstance that it's Maura's birthday. So we got the schedule and Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and we realized Maura's birthday is on Friday. Let's do this on Friday. So
yeah, it would be Maura's 35th birthday.
So you'll see the special screening. You'll be a part of a Q&A, and we have some material that we get to reveal, I guess, right?
Yep. And so in this episode coming up right now, Lance, we talk about local dirtbags, and we have the help of our friend Chloe. So she joins us, and she helped us with some of the information in this episode, as did Maggie Freeling, who joins us for a brief phone call, and Aaron Larkin also helped with some of this information.
And what you're listening to is us doing a sort of broad stroke on the local dirtbag aspect, the local dirtbag element. We hear that term that's been floated out there all the time, and it's time. We felt it was time to address this local dirtbag element, and there was a lot of stuff that you'll hear, but there was a lot of material that we didn't talk about for various reasons. You and I have had the conversation about whether or not this is a good thing. And ultimately, we came to the conclusion that it had to be done.
Yeah, I think so. And because we're reading all documented facts, right? So all everything that we talk about comes from somewhere. It's not just pulled from the sky. And if there's a local rumor that we're addressing, we will mention that it's a rumor.
What always brings me back and hones me in on whether or not we should do an episode like this and where my decision-making happens is we can't control whether or not someone has committed a crime and been convicted of something as heinous as some of these crimes are, and the fact that you live in that area. It's out there. We're going to talk about it. You know why? Because Maura is still missing. And the dogs lost her scent at a certain area, and she's still missing. And then when you look left and right and all around you, you have all sorts of these
houses, viewpoints.
It's a spider's
cars bump. Driving by. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so let us know what you think on Twitter. Find us at Maura Murray Doc. We're also on Instagram and Facebook. And find us at CrimeCon. Come say hi. We're going to be on Podcast Row. Thank you very much for listening, and we hope you enjoyed the episode. Welcome back to the Missing Maura Murray podcast. I am Tim here in the Crawl Space Studios in Wormtown, joined by Lance. What's up, Lance?
How's it going? How's everything? How's everything with you today?
Everything with me is great. Actually, it's been a wild day so far. Chloe's here as well. What's up, Chloe?
Not much. It's definitely been a wild day as far as you know the news goes.
Right, and so we're recording this on Wednesday, April 25th, but you're not hearing it on that day. Today is the day that the news announcement that the Golden State Killer had been caught. So a very big day for true crime and for cold cases. It's exciting. But here on this episode, we are talking about the area, the local area, and specifically local dirtbags.
Right. This is something that we have always referenced since the beginning-ish, that area that Maura disappeared, there's many comments about what are the odds of some local or some transient bad person who was capable and seized the opportunity to take this young woman. Because by all accounts, it does appear like she got into a car. Her scent disappears abruptly. I keep imagining a drain and that little screen that catches the crap in your sink after you do the dishes, and it drains down to this little vortex. And that area, that I'll say 5 mile area, because you do have to push out a little bit, but you don't have to try very hard to push out a little bit to get a sighting of Maura next to another one of the dirtbags. That's sort of the vortex of the drain. And what we have there is probably the worst place in that particular region that she could have disappeared. So we reference these people all the time, and we feel like now is a good time to talk about them.
We just want to kind of geographically point out where these people are and some of their offenses or alleged offenses.
Or sometimes documented offenses.
Absolutely. So we got to start with Rick, I guess, right? He's right across the street, basically right where Maura's scent went missing. It was the house he was building and the trailer that he currently lived in.
If you don't mind me backing you up a little bit,
please.
I'd like to hone in and then build out a little bit closer. I want to start with the Westmans.
Okay.
Very least, they're guilty of apathy. And I just want to say that right off the bat.
I suppose. I'm not sure I blame them for not coming out, though, when you hear the rest of this episode.
Sure. I mean, but to rope off an area of the Weathered Barns parking lot so that people can't have a safe place to park during a once-a-year anniversary at the tree is sort of apathy on top of isolationism. So
insult on top of apathy, maybe.
Insult on top of apathy with a sprinkle of isolationism.
Yeah, that I cannot combat.
So that's our first step.
Yeah.
Nothing legally bad, nothing legally, you know, convictable, but
they could have done more.
And they have a right to do what they want with their property, and obviously the public's not entitled to it, but when we try to put ourselves in their shoes and think about what we would do in that position if once a year people wanted to remember a missing woman that's probably a victim of a crime, you'd think that you would allow people to park in a safe place like that.
A crime that took place right outside your window.
That they witnessed part of.
Yeah. I think you'd have some understanding and you'd say, I'm not going to be so much of a curmudgeon on February 9th.
Yeah.
I'll pull in the reins a little bit on that, and I will allow people to park in a parking lot that is not being used at the time.
Neighbor Rick, who lived right there on the corner of Bradley Hill Road and Route 112, right across the street from Butch Atwood, Rick Forcier was building his new house. And this is, of course, 14 years ago. He was living in a trailer at the time while he was building this house that now exists there. We've often talked about how it could be possible that this guy apprehends her, but we know that there is some information about him. We know that there was at least one grand jury held, and we know that he was part of...
Was a subject of some discussion at the grand jury?
At least that.
And you're talking about Rick Forcier?
Yes.
Okay.
Let's look at a timeline of events here and look at where he says he was when Maura went missing.
There was a pretty publicized news story a couple months after Maura went missing that a new witness came forward and saw a young person wearing a black jacket with a light hood moving quickly on foot near the intersection of Route 112 and 116, which was 5 miles down the road, approximately, I think it was 30 minutes to an hour after she was last seen. And they took this account pretty seriously at first. But then there were some questions about why did it take so long for him to figure it out? And people became suspicious. That person turned out to be Rick Forcier. And what's interesting is that we've heard conflicting accounts about what he was doing around that time. So in this account, he was driving home from work. We've also heard that he was sleeping on the couch in his trailer, that he's said that on a different occasion. So when you hear conflicting stories, you wonder if someone's lying, right?
Absolutely. And that's why we're talking about it. Also, the account of him seeing a person running didn't come out until several months later.
Yeah.
So he had a different account before that, and then all of a sudden, suddenly remembered this sighting while he was in a store, and he made a joke in the store saying that Moore is a good cook.
And his excuse was that he confused the days. So when people asked him, or probably law enforcement asked him, why are you just remembering this now? He said that he mixed up the nights and he was going through his old records and realized that this was the night that he saw this young person. But it's interesting because after he made this statement, there was a formal search in that area where he said that he had last seen her, which moved some focus away from his backyard.
Okay, so the reason why we're focusing on Rick Forcier, for those who don't know, with his, you know, his past, if this had been anybody else that didn't have a sort of sketchy past, then it would be taken as a sighting. So the sighting of this person that he saw up by Hummingbird Lane, and we have to put a little dog ear in that, and we'll come back to that later because that spreads our perimeter out a little further. If it had not been Rick Forcier, they would have looked into the sighting and they probably would have discounted it or confirmed it, whether it was Maura or somebody else. But the fact that he is who he is and what we know about him causes you to suspect everything that you hear has come out of his mouth. We've made several attempts to reach him. We've emailed what we believe is his current email address.
We even left our card with our number at a coffee shop in Franconia,
which we know he frequented.
Right.
And we haven't heard back. And we do have an account from Maggie and Art when they were shooting the disappearance of Maura Murray for Oxygen, an encounter that they had with Rick that didn't go as you would expect it to go if you have nothing to hide.
Yes. And, you know, when we're reporting this information, like, you can't help but feel like he definitely has a right to speak to the things that are being said about him, some of which are being said by us. He has a right to say his side, but we'd definitely like him to, but he hasn't given us that chance.
So why are we looking into him and saying that this is a person who we just can't dismiss?
Well, what we know about him here, let's first start with a criminal record. The only thing I have here on the criminal record is a booking date of November 13th, 2009. The charge or offense is taking possession of game or wildlife, and he pled guilty to it. And that crime took place in Pennsylvania.
So taking possession of game or wildlife.
Yeah, well, we knew he was a taxidermist, right? So we would love to start as innocent as possible there. Maybe that's what he took or possessed. I mean, maybe he's a hunter. I mean, I don't think that's probably a very uncommon thing.
Right.
You know, charge if you spend a lot of time hunting or doing taxidermy. It's, you know, he's probably done that other times and not gotten caught. You know, and I don't want to speculate too much on that, but it doesn't seem like a major offense.
No, and I guess what we're assuming is that this game or wildlife is dead. The offense is taking slash possession of game or wildlife. He might have had chickens that weren't sanctioned by the town. You know,
right.
He might have had, it might be class, or a goat. You know, like you hear stories about someone who owned a goat as a pet, and then they couldn't because it wasn't. None of you guys have heard stories about a goat.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, okay. my friend owned a goat.
Okay.
I'm looking at the specific statutes of the law right now. The general rule is that it's unlawful for any person to aid, abet, attempt, or conspire to hunt for or take or possess, use, transport, or conceal any game or wildlife unlawfully. And that can include hunting before or after lawful hunting hours. So he could have just been breaking the hunting laws about what time he was, when.
Out of season, maybe?
Yeah, it's possible that he was hunting out of season. And another example of breaking this law are wild birds and wild animals taken outside of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. It is unlawful to transport or possess wild birds or wild animals from another state or nation which have been unlawfully taken, killed, or exported. So yeah, I mean, I don't think that this is necessarily correlated with
anything much. Anything too suspicious or whatever. You could read into it, but it's probably not best to. So that's what we know of his criminal past. We've heard some rumblings about some harassment currently going on up there, but we can't really speak to it. Chloe, what have you learned from talking or emailing with his ex-wife?
So last year, his ex-wife actually opened herself up and gave me the opportunity to ask her a few questions over email. And she shed some interesting insight about Rick and his behavior. Interesting piece of information. I asked her, how did you learn that Maura Murray went missing? And she said that she thought it was Wednesday that she saw a news story regarding the disappearance and that she recognized the area to be right where Rick was living. So she gave him a call and he had joked that she came to his door.
Funny joke.
Hilarious. Right. Yeah.
This is from his ex-wife.
Yes.
That's okay. The day after Maura went missing?
Wednesday, so 2 days.
2 days.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, but
wow.
Being devil's advocate, we joke about things, sort of keeps us sane.
We do,
so
but...
Nothing...
I mean, it kind of makes his account a little bit more dubious. We have someone that's calling him 2 days after and he's aware of the case, and then 3 weeks or 3 months after, he's saying a different story now about how he did see her. He had opportunity to consider this. His wife's calling him saying this woman went missing. There was police activity. He obviously was able to see the police activity 100 yards down the road. And he didn't look back and reflect, did I see something weird that night? Then he only thought about it months later.
Right. So three separate accounts, basically.
Yeah.
So one where he was on his couch, one where Maura came to his door, and one where he saw someone running about 6 miles east on his way home from work.
And one of those accounts is the joke, right?
I don't know.
Or
yeah.
If he delivered it in a sarcastic way, maybe he was telling the truth and everyone was like, oh, it must be a joke.
It just shows that he like knew something about it already, at least. Yeah,
right.
It's hard to interpret a joke because it does sound like he had a bit of a dark sense of humor. And like I'm sure that he would, if he were here with us, he would use that as his defense.
I'm sure.
You know, I'm just joking.
Right, and this is an artistic guy. He's a musician, actually. Here's a cut of one of his songs right now.
Such a stronger man, solo and alive. I'm feeling fine. I only think
pretty catchy song, Days That End in Y.
It's got a hook and you can dance to it.
Yeah, I like it.
I was thinking we should do a karaoke version of it, but...
I think that should definitely catch on.
Yeah.
But here's another one that you can find on YouTube.
In the middle of the night when I hear a creepy noise. Is it a cat in the back or a raccoon at the door? Ripping the screen, cut with a knife. Something down here don't seem right. Note on the door says you better be alone. It's a creepy Karen Stalker. Creepy Karen Stalker.
Okay, a little creepier.
The Stalker song.
Yeah, that one's called the Stalker song.
He goes a little to the dark side there, but he does it with a what I think is a bit of a tongue-in-cheek effort.
I think so.
Yeah, it seems a little goofy and a little innocent. Like, you don't see any like, sordid references there, but subject's interesting.
Right, so that's where he's at, right? Maybe he's kind of a darkly comic guy, for all we know, like, looking at it very innocently. But what else did Rebecca tell you about him joking, quote-unquote, I don't know if it's a joke, about some lake?
She had mentioned, and I think it was Lake Massabesic, she had said that he brought me to a pull-off spot on the side of Lake Massabesic to point out where a woman's body had been thrown in and weighed down by concrete blocks. Have you ever heard of anyone being found there?
And that's directly from Rebecca?
Yes.
But that account happened before Maura went missing, right?
Yes.
Okay.
And a lot of what we had talked about was it's important to determine whether she was suspicious at the time or if she's looking back with a suspicious eye based on things that she's been told after. And she was telling me about how she's struggled with that. And she wonders if she's looking at it in a biased way. And she says that she really doesn't think so just because there were things along the way that made her suspicious of him because of the way that he was behaving. And this is before Maura went missing, and it was because of other, I don't really want to go too in specific, but
allegations.
Yeah, other allegations that had come forth that made her question his character.
Other allegations that had come forth from her.
Yes. She said that there were certain things that became apparent to her in his behavior.
Okay.
Also, though, the police were coming to see her. Like, they were coming to her work. They were talking to her. They talked to her several times.
That was exactly my question.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So she said that the state police would come and speak with her frequently, and they had actually told her that he was a prime suspect. So that's kind of interesting. I don't know if they were telling her that in hopes of invoking more information out of her. You know, the police have every right to lie. When they're questioning people, if they think it would be fruitful.
Gauge your reaction.
Exactly.
Hey, have you ever used Cheapo Air?
For years, and I really like it. With Cheapo Air, you can book online, use their app, or even over the phone. They've got great prices on over 500 airlines and millions of accommodations. They're my go-to for travel planning. And if you join their Club Miles program, you can earn points to save on the cost of your travel. Book on the app and you get double points.
Sounds like it's time I tried Cheapo Air.
Call Cheapo Air at 855-247-3279 or visit cheapoair.com/podcast.
Hey, have you ever used Cheapo Air?
For years, and I really like it. With Cheapo Air, you can book online, use their app, or even over the phone. They've got great prices on over 500 airlines and millions of accommodations. They're my go-to for travel planning. And if you join their Club Miles program, you can earn points to save on the cost of your travel. Book on the app, and you get double points.
Sounds like it's time I tried Cheapo Air.
Call Cheapo Air at 855-247-3279 or visit cheapoair.com/podcast.
Hey, have you ever used Cheapo Air?
For years, and I really like it. With Cheapo Air, you can book online, use their app, or even over the phone. They've got great prices on over 500 airlines and millions of accommodations. They're my go-to for travel planning. And if you join their Club Miles program, you can earn points to save on the cost of your travel. Book on the app, and you get double points.
Sounds like it's time I tried Cheapo Air.
Call Cheapo Air at 855-247-3279 or visit cheapoair.com/podcast.
Hey, have you ever used Cheapo Air?
For years, and I really like it. With Cheapo Air, you can book online, use their app, or even over the phone. They've got great prices on over 500 airlines and millions of accommodations. They're my go-to for travel planning. And if you join their Club Miles program, you can earn points to save on the cost of your travel. Book on the app and you get double points.
Sounds like it's time I tried Cheapo Air.
Call Cheapo Air at 855-247-3279 or visit cheapoair.com/podcast.
So,
but what we know is that the trailer he sold was searched immediately after it left his property.
It was like they were sitting on it.
As soon as it was on wheels.
Right. And same thing with the house. As soon as he sold the plot of land in the house, tell us what the new owner said.
Yeah. So the people that purchased the house right after Rick sold it still live there. And I spoke with them briefly and they had told me that pretty much as soon as they purchased the house, the police asked them for permission to search because Rick would not give them permission when he was living there. And I guess they didn't have enough to get a search warrant and search the place without his permission. But the new homeowners gladly gave the police permission. They searched, and I recall the new homeowner mentioning that the police said they didn't have any particular reason to be searching, but they wanted to sort of check it off their list. I don't know, again, if they were just saying that to protect their investigation or what. Like we said, like, it's like how people say, oh, when I called in this tip to police, they didn't seem interested at all. That doesn't tell us anything. The way that they act, their attitude, it really doesn't tell us anything.
Yeah, the police, if you call in a tip, the police aren't going to be like, awesome.
Yes, thank you. You cracked the case.
Yeah, yeah. We think you might have done it. But they waited until he left. They searched his trailer after he left. And I just want to be clear that the police interest in Rick is primarily due to the proximity and their communications with Faith and Butch, two other houses that are within the proximity of Maura disappearing. So the other one is Rick Forcier. So his behavior upon being questioned is what sparked further investigation into him.
Right. He was...
starts with proximity, mm-hmm. and his behavior contributes to him being a suspect.
His proximity, the scent being lost right between his house and Butch Atwood's house, his lack of cooperation from with law enforcement and with volunteer searchers. I think there was an account early on from the McDonald's. Christine McDonald said that when she had tried to interview him, he gave her the creeps. Like she just felt very creeped out by him, and he refused to help and let them search. And there's some conjecture, oh, maybe he had pot, or maybe he just had other reasons to not want people to search. But just the fact that he was evasive and completely non-cooperative, I think, heightened law enforcement's interest. And then he comes again with having a different story.
The allegations are highly suspicious.
Yeah, and that gives us more insight on his character and what he might be capable of. And yeah.
Also, just to some perspective here, this was a guy who owned property in the White Mountains and was building his own house. And that house exists now, but yet Rick doesn't live there. Now, Rick, by all accounts, lives in a van. He has like a tool shed where he parks his van near, but he sleeps in the van. So just for some perspective, this was a guy who was married with a couple of kids, theoretically living a happy life, building a house. And then, you know, we go 14, 15, 16 years later and he's living out of a van.
Seemingly by choice. Like yeah, transient by choice.
And he makes beds in all of the vans.
Right,
so
that's not
home.
A new...
No, that's something that he had done even before he got married. But by the time Maura went missing, he was separated from his wife.
We're not intentionally trying to paint a dubious picture, but like ourselves, but we're just sort of given the paintbrushes based on the information that we have. We're not making it up.
Right.
And we're not making up the fact that Maura went missing right there. And we're not making up the fact that Rick's the way he is.
Okay, and here is Maggie Freeling's account of meeting Rick Forcier while she was with Art Roderick for the filming of Oxygen's The Disappearance of Maura Murray.
We were like staking out his place. We knew where he lived, but he has like no known schedule. So Art and I are in the car in front of his lot, and about 3 hours later, he showed up and instantly made eye contact with us. And you know, we didn't really know if he knew who we were, but we had given a phone call a couple times. One of the producers tried calling him a few times. So we roll up, like, he's getting out of his car. And then as soon as he sees us pulling up to his driveway, he immediately reverses, almost hits us, and comes flying out of the driveway down the street. And I was driving, and Art was just, follow him. And I was like, holy shit. So I floor it to follow Rick Forcier and his, like, 50-year-old van flying down the street. And we get into a high-speed chase on the highway. What highway is that right there? Was it 91?
93.
Yeah. So we're in, like, a high-speed chase on 93. And we get off at the Littleton exit. And, I mean, it was wild. We were going maybe, like, 90 on the highway trying to follow him. And my biggest question the whole time is, he doesn't even know who we are that I know of. What is he running from? Someone just pulls up to your lot. And you instantly reverse out of your driveway and floor it into a high-speed chase on the highway. Like, that was just a really crazy reaction to have.
What were you guys driving?
I was driving the Rogue.
The Nissan Rogue? Okay, so it doesn't...
The Nissan Rogue.
It's not like a police vehicle. It's not like...
No. You
know, blue lights
weren't
flashing.
Plain clothes, nothing. Like, we were just chilling in the Rogue, and we could have just been anybody. Anybody. So it was just a very bizarre reaction. And the other thing that I thought was really bizarre was... So we chased him for probably like 15 minutes on the highway, and he pulls off at the Littleton exit. Floors it left, and he pulls into a Home Depot parking lot. And that was kind of the other thing that I was like, this is weird. He doesn't know who we are again, and he's pulling into a public lot that has cameras and people around. So, like, he's thinking, you know, that we're somebody that might do something to him, is the way I felt. Like, what are you running from that when you finally do stop, it's in a public place?
He sounds almost paranoid.
Yeah, no, totally, totally. He stops, like, he knew we were just going to keep chasing him, and this was not a good situation really for anybody. So we get out of the car, he stays in his van, and we walk over, and Art says, are you Mr. Forcier? And he said, no. We obviously knew it was him from his videos online. And he had a guitar in the front seat, and his van has got a bunch of shit in the back. There's like a mattress, and it's just like piles of stuff. And Art just said, nice guitar, Mr. Forcier. And that's kind of when he knew that we knew that it was him. And he said, didn't I not call you people back? And we were like, I don't know. Because again, the producer called, and we assumed we didn't hear back. We didn't have an interview with him. He said, didn't I not call you people back? And we were like, I don't know. Did you not call us back? And he said, when you don't get a phone call, that's me. And he was talking in like really bizarre speech patterns and like double negatives. When you don't get a phone call, that's me. It was like, what are you, what? Art then said, okay, Mr. Forcier, we want to talk to you about Maura Murray. And he just said, I have nothing to say. And we said, you don't want to talk to us? We just have a few questions. He said, I have nothing to say.
Did this occur around the anniversary?
No, I don't think it did. I think it was after. This was like later into our filming, I think.
Were there cameras around when he first saw you guys? And then were there cameras around in the parking lot when you guys talked?
No, because we floored it away from the production crew. Like, we were out of, like, walkie-talkie signal, like, everything. Like, we were just going. So we lost all the vans of cameras. So it was just us and the GoPro.
So when he first saw you, were there... I mean, I'm just trying to get at, was there any indication that he knew that he was talking to people from the TV show?
No. No. I think he knew that there were, I think because Audra had called and said, like, you know, hey, we'd like to talk to you. We're working on this documentary about Maura Murray. I think he knew there were people in the area. But we were just sitting there in the Rogue, and the van with all the cameras was way behind us. So it wasn't really that obvious. I guess what is obvious is that he lives in a vacant lot out of his van, and it's a road that there's normally not cars parked in front of. So to see two cars like parked by his property, he's definitely not a stupid person.
Right.
You know, he knew when Art and I are pulling, like slowly pulling up to his driveway to just get out and be like, hey, can we talk to you?
He was expecting the documentary crew to show up at where he lived at some point, it seems like.
And he could tell that you guys were waiting, yeah, which probably freaked him out.
He could tell. I don't know if he knew we were the documentary crew or who, but I mean, why are you getting into a high speed car chase to run from a documentary crew also?
Yeah, and to paint the picture that that it's not like he lives down a road. It's like he lives on a turnaround off of a road. There's not like a lot of reason for anybody else to be in that area.
Unless you're shoveling his driveway, which Lance did.
Unless you're being a courteous neighbor and taking care of some snow removal
for
him.
That was really neighborly.
He left town at the around the anniversary.
I just wanted to make sure that he had a clear path when he returned.
Right. Well, that was the thing. We were actually trying to invite him to the vigil at the VFW in 2017, and he seemed to have left town because...
He had other engagements.
Yeah, and it was snowing a lot that weekend, and Lance shoveled his driveway.
We were there. I thought I'd just do a humane thing.
And the reason that Rick Forcier's quote-unquote sighting, we don't know if it's true, is important is because it does put her right at that corner who lives on that corner, guys.
A little bit down Hummingbird Lane, you have our hero, Greg Floyd.
Of course, you're being sarcastic calling him our hero.
Right, that is...
Got a dark sense of humor there, Lance. Just kidding. Yeah, Greg came up in our episode Showdown in Franconia because he was directly involved in the showdown between Leek O'Kenny and Officer
Bruce McKay.
Bruce McKay, where he became directly involved in this incident and ended up shooting and killing Leek O'Kenny.
Right. And anybody out there listening was like, I'm sure there are people who are very familiar with this. I hope people are out there saying, like, they keep talking about Greg Floyd and Rick Forcier and Claude Moulton. Yeah.
This is why. Yeah.
Keep listening. Keep talking about them. Make them household names.
So just looking at his record real quick, simple assaults, arrested on June 4th, 2011, arrested in New Hampshire. Also in New Hampshire, arrested in 1997, not specific. There's also a conviction from a drug charge in Georgia. So, I don't know, just to paint the picture of who this guy is, if you didn't know the Leek O'Kenny, Greg Floyd, Bruce McKay triangle of fate that we always talk about here. So that just in case Rick's account or his sighting was true, that's where it puts Maura, near his house.
And from what we're looking at here, it's likely that Greg Floyd has at least six arrests on his record, from simple assault to... criminal traffic felonies. So this is someone with a bit of a track record.
And there's also that, you know, the local talk about him having pulled a gun on a utility meter reader. Remember?
Yeah.
Remember that from, I think it was from the Boston Magazine article. There was some anecdote about him trying, like threatening to shoot someone that was coming. Yeah, the utility meter reader.
Next up, of course, is the guy who was staying in the A-frame house at the time. Now, this is just a little bit up the road, the opposite way from where we know, from how we believe Maura to have been driving that night. So this would have been west of the accident. And then you got to take a little left up Valley Road, and you will run into the A-frame house, which is currently for sale, side note. But Claude Moulton lived at this house at the time of Maura's disappearance. Of course, we've been over this guy several times on this podcast, most in-depth being episode 67 called Inside the A-Frame with the old owners of the A-Frame house. And we know that there was blood samples found in the downstairs closet of the A-Frame house in which Claude lived in. He had some... interesting allegations against him as well, some really dark ones, I would say. And there was this blood in the house, and there was this cadaver dog search that was done in 2005 that hit on that downstairs closet, and then you add the blood found from the oxygen disappearance of Maura Murray TV show, two different people's blood found in that closet downstairs. one female. We're not sure about the other one. Haven't gotten a full profile that we know of to date.
Right. This is something that, you know, is just sort of like a thorn in the in our side when it comes to the frustration and not having any access to official information. I mean, that's all that, like, what you can say is what it is. It's cadaver dogs that that we know go nuts in this house. Cadaver dogs do not go nuts over dead raccoons. You know, they go nuts over dead human. And then you have what's probably blood stains that the luminol lit up. And then we have two sets of actual blood stains.
Yes, for sure. Confirmed samples of human blood. Yeah.
Right.
From
the wall of the downstairs closet. So you have these contributing factors. And again, well, let's take Claude out of the equation. You should have a connective tissue there to investigate something there because of cadaver dogs and bloodstains.
And the reason why we're even talking about him is because his brother came forward to Fred with a rusty knife and said that he believed that his brother could be involved. And I'm being careful because I'm not going to say what his motivations were behind doing that. It could be because he was actually suspicious of his brother. He was trying to make his brother look bad. It could have been vindictive. We don't know why he did it, but we know that he did it, that he did go to Fred and say that.
Right.
And we know that he did leave the A-frame shortly after.
Sure. And the rusty knife, if you're wondering and hadn't heard, was sent to New Hampshire State Police by Fred Murray. They have apparently tested it, so they say, but we did not hear any results. You can only imagine. It doesn't have Maura's blood on it, if it has any blood at all.
Okay, so you got the brother doing that thing with the knife, and it has to do with Maura Murray, and you have other talk out there about how his brother and him had a falling out over a car that they were supposedly borrowing from each other, and he was going to return it, and there was something about, you know, if you don't do this, I'll tell everybody what happened to Maura Murray. How does her name keep coming up between these two brothers? That's a question that probably can just sit out there in the ether.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Like, yeah, absolutely.
If you have nothing to do with the disappearance of Maura Murray and you live in that area in the proximity, it seems like right now the first two people we covered, three people we've covered, including the brothers and Rick Forcier, all decide that this is a good thing to joke about. All decide that this is now our you know, pinpoint joke when we want to threaten somebody in our family or we want to just, you know, have a dark sense of humor. It's funny that it comes back over a decade later.
He keeps coming back to Maura.
Okay, now from the A-frame house, there is a little bit of connective tissue to this other property that would be just west of where Maura disappeared, just west of the Westmans and down a little bit of a road getting closer to the Wild Ammonoosuc River. Now, the connection is Claude's girlfriend at the time Maura went missing. Her name was Skye. She has a sister who lived at this property right down the street. Her name is Erica. Erica was involved with one of the men living at that house. Now, these are names that Mr. Murray gets hit with. These names come up a lot. So Erica actually testified against this guy, Greg Boutelier.
So where Gary was residing at the time was within that vicinity that we're talking about, this, you know, maybe 500-yard vicinity of Maura's disappearance. Now, so we're bringing up, just to be clear, we're bringing up Gary Boutelier because he lived in a property that was very close in the vicinity of Maura's disappearance. Now, he was one of the men who was accused of sexually assaulting David Aldridge's daughter. This is something we're not making up. This is part of a disturbing and disgusting court document where she accounts of her father, David Aldridge, her uncles, Virgil and Alan Aldridge, of molesting her when she was a child. She also includes her mother's boyfriend's father, Gary Boutelier, of sexually assaulting her, and a family friend, Michael Gadois, of sexually assaulting her. This is all within that area where Maura disappeared.
And in this document describes repeated assaults from when the victim was in between ages 10 and 17.
Graphic depictions of of what happened, and she was discounted by her mother, saying she made it up, and there's a lot of back and forth. But the bottom line is David Aldridge stood trial between September 10th and 16th, 2014. After the state rested, the court dismissed all three incest indictments and all but two of the aggravated sexual assault indictments. Those two indictments alleged that he had his daughter perform fellatio on him between July 98 and July 99, and he committed an act of digital penetration between July of 2000 and May of 2001. The jury convicted him on each charge and sentenced him to 10 to 20 years on the first charge and 7.5 to 15 years consecutive on the other charge.
We talk about people that are local because when you're looking at this crime, you think about someone that would feel safe and comfortable picking up a young lady in plain sight of houses. And I think someone that would feel comfortable doing that is someone that lives there and someone that travels those roads on a regular basis. I mean, that's not definitely the profile of who did it, but I think that it makes sense and it fits.
And it's also not definitely a crime that we know of.
Right.
We are at this point kind of following, I think, the police's lead and kind of acting like it is.
Yeah, working under the assumption that this was foul play, which has been asserted by law enforcement as their most dominant theory, and I feel like the three of us feel personally is the most likely scenario, then that's probably the kind of person that would do that.
The rabbit hole of this case is that when you look at one element, it leads to so many other elements that are just as or more so disturbing than the what you were looking at in the first place, right?
Also, speaking of the Aldriches, there is the account, and we're not really sure where this came from yet, but there is an account that Maura was seen in a car with Dave and Alan Aldrich.
Again, those things that are out there in the ether that we can't really put a pin in and say this is exactly where it came from. But what we're getting at is it's the next rock that you overturn. And I'm turning over the David Aldridge rock. Why? Because it was Gary Boutelier, which came from the brush burning, which brought us to David Aldridge, which brought us to the child molestation charges, which brought us to an account of Maura possibly being seen in a vehicle with him. These are things that I wish that we could have a moment where we turn something over and we say, that's just that.
And you could just rule it out.
Rule it out.
It would be great.
Yeah. Rule that out. That guy or that woman, they're a decent person.
And something else that's really interesting we'll leave you with here today, and trust us, there are some more local dirtbags, that so much so that we could probably do an episode 2, like we're specifically not mentioning a few. But just want to leave you with something that we got emailed and sort of a thought that's been hanging around for a little while, and it was a really good thought. It was the fact that Maura's phone, as far as we know, never got back into service. So she either shut her phone off when she left the area and never turned it back on if she left willingly, or she just never left that area, or at least her phone never did.
Her phone never left that area.
And if it did, it had been shut off.
Right. So to work backwards from that, the reason why we're saying that is the Londonderry ping. So we know her phone was turned on.
At one point during her trip to check a voicemail, and it pinged, someone called her phone from Londonderry, New Hampshire, and then she shut her phone back off until the spin-out at the old weathered barn corner, and then she turned it back on, but she wasn't in service, therefore the phone couldn't ping off of any cell phone towers telling anyone where she was.
But we do know that the cell phone would have pinged had it been on by Beaver Pond, based on Witness A's account of routinely calling to make sure that the people she was calling knew where she was en route from her work to
There's service there.
To this day, that's where you go
to get
service again when you're traveling down Route 112.
Right, right. So to capsulize that thought, you can't track Maura's body, but you are able to track the whereabouts of her phone, and if it was not pinging off of anything, that means it was either off or it was not moving. So if it was not moving, was it on her person or was it left behind? And right now we don't know where the phone is.
Has never been found.
Well, it wasn't in her car. We know that. So
thank you to the emailer for that, because it's those little nuggets, those little details that really you think it's minutia, but it's not. I mean, there has to be a logical explanation for everything in this case.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hey, have you ever used Cheapo Air?
For years, and I really like it. With Cheapo Air, you can book online, use their app, or even over the phone. They've got great prices on over 500 airlines and millions of accommodations. They're my go-to for travel planning. And if you join their Club Miles program, you can earn points to save on the cost of your travel. Book on the app, and you get double points.
Sounds like it's time I tried Cheapo Air.
Call Cheapo Air at 855-247-3279 or visit cheapoair.com/podcast.
Hey, have you ever used Cheapo Air?
For years, and I really like it. With Cheapo Air, you can book online, use their app, or even over the phone. They've got great prices on over 500 airlines and millions of accommodations. They're my go-to for travel planning. And if you join their Club Miles program, you can earn points to save on the cost of your travel. Book on the app, and you get double points.
Sounds like it's time I tried Cheapo Air.
Call Cheapo Air at 855-247-3279 or visit cheapoair.com/podcast.